A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
So do you want to introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about yourself.
So I'm David C. Hall, founder of Potential Unlocked. And we specialize in training children in their greatness to lead a fulfilled, successful, and a transformed life. I'm a best-selling author of two books, to include The Empowering Parent, released in January 20, yeah. And my second book, released October 21, entitled Inspire Your Child's Greatness, 7 Principles to Guide Young People from Struggle to Their Success. I've appeared in a range of media or media outlets even, to include the Birmingham Mail, which is like a local newspaper, The Voice, a national newspaper, and the Forbes magazine, which is a international media outlet.
What do you do then? When you say inspire people, how do you go about inspiring people?
That's a great question. I believe all of us have got a story inside of us designed to inspire people, invigorate people around what they can achieve if they dare to believe. Mm-hmm. And so my story, in short, is that I'm 38 years young. And the key word there is 38 years young, because age is ultimately a number.
We're the same age.
1983?
Yeah.
What month?
May.
Oh, May, December.
Ah, winter, baby. You're very chirpy for a winter, baby.
But yeah, so essentially, I was diagnosed as being dyslexic very early on in my school career, when I was in reception. And as a child growing up, my self-esteem was really low, and so was my confidence, because I thought I was a failure, because speaking in public was a massive, massive challenge for me. I was stutter, so I had a speech therapist to support with my speech delay. My spellings were atrocious, as my writing. Social skills were very limited due to my poor self-esteem. And as I journeyed through primary school, being statemented in the 1980s, and finding school very challenging, very overwhelming, I was finally reintegrated back into mainstream education in year six. And in those days, you did the SATs in year six, as you do now. Mm-hmm. And I was assessed as being 4 years behind my peers, having attained a level 2B, which is maybe 4 years behind my peers. And that, again, was quite devastating, that it was documented I'm so far behind compared to my peers. And having to progress on to secondary school, at my first parents' evening, I was told that essentially that I'm a lovely young person, really hardworking, but based on my SATs results, I wouldn't really attain anything substantial. And in that moment, again, I felt really deflated, very upset, and thought, well, what's the point in working hard if I'm going to fail anyway? But I have, and I had, very supportive parents who saw my potential and believed that I could succeed and that I can succeed. And leaving that parents' evening, we had a display board of all the high achievers outside the head teacher's office. Mm-hmm. My mom said to me, David, one day you're going to be up there on that board with all the high attainers. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, she's right. And I decided to believe my mom's opinion or my mom's judgment of my potential as opposed to my teacher. And that was my turning moment, where I was determined to make something of myself, to be a high attainer in my school, despite being dyslexic, despite being statemented previously, despite having low self-esteem and confidence. But I was determined to turn it right around over 5 years in my secondary school.
So you've said you found out pretty early, right? That was free, was that right?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Free. So who discovered it? Was one of your teachers discovered it? Was it based in your, were you in a state school?
No, so my parents were very much aware of what dyslexia actually was.
Mm-hmm.
And
Was that? That's quite rare for 83, 86.
It is quite rare, absolutely. Because someone in my family has it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they're quite aware of the signs of it.
Yeah.
So I got assessed quite earlier on.
Mm-hmm. What signs did you show to begin with?
I had a speech delay.
Yeah.
Challenges with writing and so on.
Okay. And how do you think that affected you socially at school?
Very challenging in that when your peers are really excelling,
yeah,
and you're not,
yeah,
your friends are getting high grades and I'm not,
yeah,
where you having to work twice as hard to get good results later on in life,
mm-hmm,
because you haven't developed your what I call your learning flow,
mm-hmm,
and so everything was a lot more harder for myself. Just simple things like reading a text and knowing what it actually is saying to me.
Mm.
Things like preparing for an exam, it was very challenging. It was an ordeal, essentially.
Yeah. So your parents picked up based on one of your siblings had similar signs, so that's kind of an early warning.
Wasn't a sibling, somebody in my family.
Oh, sorry, okay. Yeah, someone in your family. Okay, so they picked up on it, which is obviously amazing because most parents at the time was really... I found that 83, the early 80s, was actually the time when it was started getting picked up really early from everyone we've had on the show. Before that, it was quite later on in life they found out when they was older, but when we came through school, it was actually being picked up a lot more because I was diagnosed at 7. So, and I thought that, and everyone tells me how early that was, so it's a bit free is amazing, really. So that gave you enough time to kind of adapt to the way you do things. Like you said, you studied different and stuff like that. Out of interest, was there anything you excelled at school that was outside the realms of academia?
Well, I've always had a keen interest in sort of taking things apart, putting things back together again. Mm-hmm. That was my forte. Thoroughly enjoyed sciences because, mm-hmm, for me, science explains the world that we lived in, gave context as to why things actually happen.
Yeah.
So I got memories of my mum buying me a science set and so on. So they were my keen interests really as a child growing up.
Yeah. You said, obviously, it sounds to me like your parents, your mum particularly, was a very important part of this. How did your mum know how to deal with it? Because a lot of people we have on the show, sometimes the parents are amazing and other times, like my parents would have liked to help. They helped in the only way they could, which was sent me to a tutor. But some parents have really excelled in like help setting up a regimented regime and trying to get things really... How did your mum know how to help you in that way?
My parents were just amazing, very supportive.
Yeah.
They gave me tuition support on the weekends. My dad bought my brother and I a computer. So I was able to improve my grammar skills.
Mm-hmm.
So... earlier on, whenever I would use Microsoft 1997, all those years ago, I would have lots of red lines and green lines, red showing spelling errors, green for grammatical errors. But as I began to type more, do my homework on a computer, have it word processed, I was able to reduce those lines to now, when I do type on a computer, there are not errors pretty much because I've mastered the skill of memorizing how words look.
Yeah.
To understand what makes a strong sentence in terms of grammatical strength and so on. So that really helped as well.
One of my friends, it's funny you say that, one of my friends contacted me a few days ago and said, he said, I need to ask a question about this dyslexia thing, even though I'm pretty sure he's dyslexic. If he's listening, it'd be interesting to see what he says to me now. He said, I've got a member of staff that terrible at writing emails and he blames his dyslexia. Anyway, I sent an email about something else to him because we worked together for other places. And he said, that was an incredible email. I thought you were dyslexic. And I was like, I am dyslexic, but I'm also awesome at writing emails. So I wrote this program for this dyslexia walkthrough for his staff member. And I've done a video to help them. And he hasn't done it yet, so he's back from holiday soon, so he's going to do it then. But it's interesting, the perception is that dyslexic people can't write, when actually my ability to be creative in my writing is actually not true. It's me getting the grammar and the spellings right. But with technology, it's made it so easy now.
It has.
The only problem is when I don't have it, I don't realise I'm... So when I write... In fact, even I had to sign in to the studio this morning and I haven't written anything for ages and it was so weird writing even my name. I was like, oh, I forgot how little I don't do this anymore. It's just funny because you said about computers it just has changed the way we cope with things a lot better.
It has. It's a massive support to have that in place. And so you're able, like in my case, I was able to learn how words should look.
Mm-hmm.
So that helped me to memorize spellings by knowing how it looks on paper or on the screen, as it were.
So you finished education and then you went into teaching first, is that right?
I did.
I think that's amazing. I love teaching. So tell me a bit about that.
Sure. So I went into teaching. So I did a degree in chemistry.
Oh, wow.
Which took me 6 years to complete as opposed to 3. Because my dad was in hospital for 19 months straight.
Mm.
So I had to do it part-time until I was able to pass my degree in chemistry.
Amazing.
Then I did my PGCE to become qualified, and I taught in school for 2 terms and realised that I wanted to make more of an impact by creating the right environment for children to really flourish and helping children to believe that they can succeed. Because I think a lot of times within an educational environment, it's built for a specific type of learner.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, there's something called the Industrial Revolution.
Mm.
And that's the premise of the Industrial Revolution is more geared towards helping people to be educated by having standardized tests to determine where they can work in the future, to be taught in a specific way, and to be taught what to learn, but not necessarily how to learn effectively.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a missing key, really, for young people, particularly children who are neurodiverse. And they need to be taught in a slightly more creative way so they're able to really flourish and find out what I call their learning flow. So learning becomes a lot more simple for them and more enjoyable as opposed to being very much enduring, agonizing experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's a common myth, isn't it, that dyslexic people aren't good learners or even good academically. And that is actually a complete myth. It's just the way we learn is very different.
Yes.
Given the right circumstances in the right learning environment, we're equally as good at learning. So I think that's the most common thing that people say to me that's not true.
Yeah, I do agree. Ultimately, we all can learn irrespective of our disposition.
Yeah.
But the key thing is we understand how to learn effectively. So if we're working with lots of young people and from our own experiences too, I've realised that we need to learn in more of a creative way, and that's how we have our potential unlocked when we are able to learn through more creative ways. Because ultimately learning's about being able to understand the work or understand the context, the content even, I mean to say, but equally to be able to memorise that content by understanding it and use it in the future in the right context. And that's what it's about, really, helping children to learn effectively so they're not frustrated and underachieving.
You went into teaching, then you thought there'd be better environments for neurodiverse people to learn in, or children generally. And then what did you do after that? You went into, was it tutoring or something you stepped into?
Yeah,
then?
So I started a tuition company. So originally I had a tuition company earlier on.
Yeah.
And realised that tuition is effective to a degree, but that's more around learning what to learn. So exploring the content, for example, of science, English or maths, of your subjects. But I realised that a lot of people underachieve due to a skewed self-concept.
Yep.
So they have decided that they're not intelligent, or they can't learn, or learning is boring, whatever it may be. But they have resided to the fact that they can't learn.
Yeah,
and so most of the work is more geared around supporting people to understand you are intelligent. You are intelligent in your own right. However, we got to work through your skewed self-concept. Because ultimately, the grades that we achieve is a reflection of our self-concept. And once we begin to work on the self-concept and support them with the right method of learning, that's when the grades tend to go up over time.
Yeah.
Because what I've said to a lot of parents and people in general as well is that our results that we achieve in our life is a direct reflection of our confidence levels and also our self-concept.
Confidence levels, this is something I'm very passionate about and recently been speaking to a lot of people about. How, obviously, confidence levels isn't just for neurotypical people have these problems as well as neurodiverse people. What do you think the issue is with confidence? Because from what I can tell from speaking to kids in schools, the confidence levels seem to have gone down generally. What do you think is the cause of that? And I'm aware it's just going to be your opinion. So,
so confidence is belief in your ability to get something done.
Hmm.
And so if you're in a situation where you're constantly getting a grade E, over the course of a year, whatever time frame it may be, the confidence to say that actually I can get a grade A will be quite low because they feel a bit defeated. So what has to happen is we've got to put the work in to rebuild that confidence. So I believe that I can succeed and help them to rewrite their script around, you know, they can succeed, because ultimately the results that we have is down to our self-concept, and that's built around our scripting.
Yeah.
So if we tell ourselves by our internal dialogue, I can't do it, it's too hard, I never will, guess right, the person is right. But conversely, if they believe that they can achieve something, that they are great at something, guess what, they're right also. So it's about trying to...
So that's kind of like, I think, therefore I am.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So as we think by our script and our self-concept, we become.
Hmm.
And so we're working with lots of young people and children and people as well. That's the first breakthrough. So I call it the glass ceiling, being able to see what you can achieve, but then we are prohibited by our limiting beliefs. And by helping them to choose more empowering thoughts, working with the right methodologies and so on, they're able to succeed.
Is that not more to do with the people we surround ourselves with? Because I'm a strong believer in we are the sum of the five people we spend our time with.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that comes down to friendship groups, the home environment, and the learning environment all helps with our self-concept. And so the key thing is that we are choosing friends who are going to help us to grow and reach our full potential, but equally to be around groups of people who will see our potential and help us to achieve our goals as well.
So here's another question I get regularly. And again, it's not necessarily to do with neurodiverse people, but definitely on the same confidence path. Because the one thing I tell everyone is the reason why I have got where I've got, and I'm not saying it's a great place where I've got, but generally the reason why I've got as far as I have is my confidence levels that was instilled by my parents, who were both insanely confident. Even if you met them now, you'd go, Jesus, they are two very confident 70-year-olds. My mum, I think, still thinks she's a model and stuff like that. They're very, very confident. I get all my confidence from them. How do you... Now, there was a point in my life where I got to a crossroads where the people I hung around with weren't the people I could go on to the next step of my life, my journey with. So I had a decision to make. And my decision at the time was, it's not they haven't done anything wrong, it's me that's changing. Actually, they've stayed the same. So I'm going to kind of pull away from that group and meet other people or go it along on my own. And when I get where I am, there'll be more people there to become friends with. But I get a lot of people, especially people, teenagers, who say, what's the right choice when you get to a point in your life where the people that surround you are no longer the right people? They may be toxic, or they may just have a very different view to you in life. What do you think is the best kind of option or a bit of advice you can give about that?
The best advice I can give is ultimately we become like the people who we spend most of our time with. So either we influence them or they influence us. And so the key thing is to understand what I call is our long-term goal and know what our purpose actually is. And choosing friends that will help us to reach our full potential and be able to support us on that path. Because ultimately, the purpose of a friend is to support you in your purpose.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen. We've got to reevaluate our close friends around us.
Yeah. I always say to people, there's a time in life when you need to, obviously there's certain people, I would never say cut out family members and stuff like that. I've got three brothers. Sometimes I like some of them, sometimes I don't like some of them. It's just that way family goes. I'd never cut any of them out of my life. But there's certainly, you can certainly guard your time with people. I always say this, if the option is not that, because cutting out isn't always a good thing. I know a lot of people glorify that. especially self-help gurus or really successful entrepreneurs. I mean, you see lots of videos of multimillionaires going, oh, I just cut all my friends out and went it alone. And although that might be good for your business and financial growth, it won't be good for your mental growth, I don't think. But I always said there's times when you can set limits on how long you spend with people due to how much you share things in your life. So I've got a friend who's I love, but they're an hour friend. You know, for 1 hour, we have so much fun with each other. We always say how great our time is. But if we go into 3 hours, I know the conversation would probably take a darker turn. It probably wouldn't be as fruitful as it is when we spend an hour with each other. So, and we both know this about each other because I'm very into business and work and I love talking about things like that. And he's probably best described as a free spirit. Whereas after 3 or 4 hours, he'd want to talk about building a citadel in the middle of nowhere where no one exists but raising animals. You know, it kind of gets into the two very opposite sides. But that for that 1 hour, we're together, we've got a great friendship, and we share so much happiness around each other. So I always say to people, putting a limit on time isn't necessarily a bad thing, but that way you can get to spend different things. And then alternatively, I've got other friends that I could spend a week with on holiday, and every second kind of makes it feel like you're building yourself up.
I totally agree, Andrew, totally agree, in that, you know, in this life, we have to ensure that we're able to inspire people and support them. We've seen their potential and be there for them as well. But equally, have people who I would say are able to challenge us so that we can grow and develop. And develop, but also have people who are our peers. So it's more of a sideway thing.
Yeah.
And just being aware of where people are and supporting them. Because ultimately, it's about making an impact. I mean, that can only happen if we are able to support people and people support us.
Yeah.
And the more that we're able to serve and make an impact, it will come back to us in different ways too, as people will see our potential and support us. So I believe it's more of a judgment call in knowing where to spend your time and who to spend more time with, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And the reasons for doing that as well.
Hi, everyone. I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing and sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that want to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com. And you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
So when it comes to neurodiverse people, obviously there's a smaller amount of us. And sometimes when you're at school and it's harder, it becomes isolating. You feel very isolated. I personally didn't, but obviously there's a lot of people that out there that do. Do you think the best circles or things are to do when you feel a bit isolated during school because of your neurodiversity? What do you think the best kind of ways out of that is?
Yeah, if you feel a bit lonely because of neurodiversity, it's about forming friendship groups who got similar interests as you, and be able to just to talk about how you feel, your challenges, support each other with your challenges. But equally, to seek out people who are 5 years ahead of you as well and can sort of say, well, actually, I've been through this. This is how I overcame. Or ultimately, these are things you can be doing, or try to avoid doing these things. Just to have that sort of mental figure in your life as well. That's what I would say.
So let's get on to the next step. After you've done your teaching and you've gone on to started up your business on teaching privately, you've got into public speaking, which is something most people either fear or love the idea of. What got you into that?
Yeah, ultimately, I really enjoy inspiring people to see their potential and to believe their potential and helping them to really think about what is possible. Some of the times people I call are in an occupational paradigm because they are counting down to when it's the weekend or Monday comes and thinking, oh, I wish it's the weekend again, or counting down to the next holiday. But I believe we are designed to live in what I call the vocational paradigm. And that's when we really enjoy what we're doing. We're in our zone where time goes really quick. We feel infused, we feel energized by doing what we're doing. And that's what my mission is, to help people to find their gifts and talents and to find a way that it been expressed through a business or through the corporate world where they can make a difference in this world and be paid their worth. And so I'm on a mission really to help people to live a fulfilled life so they can be successful, but ultimately so they can leave a legacy too in their life.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm about really, helping people to see their potential and have that potential unlocked.
So I suppose if you want people to go out, I say this to everyone all the time, they're like, oh, how did you get into what you did? And I always say to people, if you ask the question of, I don't know how I got here, the chances are you've done it on a whim and haven't planned anything, which isn't necessarily a bad thing because some people have ended up in great positions like that. But when I say to people, the key to life is actually happiness. I personally think happiness and legacy. So giving back. The world should be a better place than when you got here. When you leave it, definitely should be better. So, and there's lots of ways to do it. I personally think you should do it behind closed doors. I'm not a big believer in telling everyone what you're up to. I like to be called the helpful ninja, which is where I do things behind the scenes. And the reason why I say to people is the key to life is happiness. And a lot of people say, yeah, but then you've got, the question comes out about money and jobs. And what happens is a lot of people at a young age get forced into making work decisions or life decisions too young, to a point where they get into a situation where they're stuck. So, for example, if you worked in a corporate world, say doing insurance or something like that in city, an amazing paid job. And at the time when you've gone from a low level up, you've built up your career, you've built up your money, you've got a life that matches it, a family that matches it, and then you get to a point where that job is not fulfilling you anymore. Now, what people say to me, well, I can't do anything now, because if I decide I want to go do something, it's going to affect everything I have, and then I'll probably be unhappier than I am now. Do you think we should be doing something earlier on in people's lives to change the old-fashioned way of saying, because I hear it all the time, adults go to kids, what do you want to do when you're older? Or what are you going to do when you're older? Or what courses are you going to take? Because they try and make people so young decide what they're going to do. So when they become adults, they're probably doing something that they don't know what they wanted to do in the first place.
My training company exists to help young people, children as well, to become aware of their strengths, the gifts and talents. Because as you rightfully pointed out, there's lots of people are in the occupational paradigm, in a business or a job, because it pays the bills, it pays a great salary, they get very comfortable, the lifestyle is in line with what they get paid. So thinking, well, if I do something that I'm passionate about, then I need to take a pay cut. But ultimately, successful people make a living through their gifts and talents, through their passion. And the key thing there is being fulfilled in what we're doing, because once we are fulfilled in what we're doing, then the money will follow.
Yeah.
And I operate by the principle of serving people, making tangible difference to people, and in doing so, the money will follow in abundance. So if you can serve 10 people, 1,000 people, whatever it may be, money will come back to you as you serve. And so the advice that I would give to anybody who feels a bit trapped at the moment, because I feel, well, actually, I'm 40 years old now, I need to pay my mortgage, or I'm 50, it's too late to start now. What I would say to encourage it is, age is only a number. Age is only a number. Be encouraged that that you are able to make this transition into your passion, because the world is waiting for you to step out today to make a difference.
Mm.
And if you stay in your business or in your job because it pays the bills, mm. then my concern is you're going to leave this earth being unfulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to leave this earth knowing that we made a tangible difference to leave a legacy.
Mm.
And so the first step is always hardest to make, the first step.
Yeah.
Once you make the first step, step two becomes evident, step three, step four. And before you know it, you're thinking, wow, I've come from here to there.
Yeah.
But the key thing is having the courage, making a plan, writing down your goals, thinking big. There's no such thing as I can't.
Mm-hmm.
All of us are born with greatness. All of us are born in a perfect sense that, you know, there's not such thing as impossible, but possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as being limited, but we are unlimited in our potential. But we got to believe that we can succeed.
Mm-hmm.
We got to believe that we got gifts and talents. And that, you know, that we have value to give to the world, that we can make a difference in the world, and that you're worthy to make a difference. And once we reside to believing and thinking that, then the first step will become easier to make as we begin to do what I call a gap analysis as to where we are right now, to where we need to be, and put together a plan in place to get to where we want to be.
Yeah, and I would say there's one thing I've learned recently from employing younger people is actually if you have a passion, you can still stay in your job and do that passion on the side. The old days of, again, really rich, successful people saying, quit your job and just do it. That was something I done. I quit my job. I was a scaffolder. Used to earn a lot of money as a scaffolder. Quit my job and started and as an engineer. And the financial implications of that rippled through my life for 10 years. And it was so painful, but that was a right decision for me, and it was quick, and it was just getting to where I needed to faster. However, if you do have passions, you should always do your passions on the side, regardless of whether it's for money or work or anything. So what I always say to people about, I go to the gym, although I don't look like it, but I do go to the gym a lot. I absolutely love it. And without that passion in my life, I would be probably a lot less chirpier than the person that's sitting in front of you. So kind of like an add-on to what you said, you can really achieve anything. You don't have to give up everything in order to start. You can always start on the side. Like you said, helping one person at a time and building up the people that help you. Ultimately, every business is people wanting something you either make or service them with. So it's just building up numbers of people that want it. And when it's time, and you will know it's time, you can step away from that job that's not the fulfillment into the new one.
That's precisely it. I totally agree. And that's the key thing there, with being very much aware of our gifts and talents. And if we find that we are later on in life, then maybe do two side by side for that reason, to build the skill sets needed to in entrepreneurship and building network and so on. But equally, I'll encourage any young person, if you're at home, work on your passion, use education as a way to refine your gifts and talents. Education in Latin means educator, which means to draw out one's potential. So education should be used as a way to refine your gift, to grow your grit, to develop a gift, so we're able to reach self-mastery. Because ultimately, if we are operating our gifts and talents from a high level, there is no competition, because we are great at what we do. You do things in a unique way, which is your signature product, as it were. So that's what I would say to any young person. You know, if you've got a gift and talent, go full steam in a gift and talent, because it's easier to make a mistake when you're younger than when we are more mature in life, because there's more consequences when we are more mature in life, as it were.
So when you talk to people about motivating, is it a large group of people, or is it predominantly, and when I say large group of people, I mean in size, I mean diverse group of people, because I think it's very easy to talk to people who have come up through life with a lot more privilege than others, but it's for me, I always try to help people that come from more similar backgrounds to where I came from, which is trying to help the people that wouldn't normally attend an event or something like that. Do you have a diverse background where you speak to different people?
Yes, because it's important that we work with a diverse range of demographics to ensure that we can inspire a whole range of young people and children. and adults as well in their greatness. For example, we do an annual event called Potential Unlocked Awards. And last year at October, we had Les Brown, who's a renowned speaker.
Les Brown. He's my favourite.
He's amazing. He's a wonderful person. So he was our headline speaker last year. And the event is designed to really inspire people around what you can achieve. So we give awards to children, young people, adults who've achieved amazing things. So, for example, we had a young boy who was 7 years old, written his first book at 7 years old.
Wow.
He has his own publisher company at seven. We gave an award out to a lady called called Stephanie Taylor. She's a single mum, has an amazing story, had the challenges there, has built a sizable portfolio. So she won the award as an inspirational person of the year. So we gave lots of awards on the night to people who are inspiring. So the whole premise of the event is to give recognition to people who've achieved amazing results in their own rights, but equally, conversely, to inspire the audience around what you can achieve when you dare to believe and put the work in. So that's how I inspire people as well, and through our annual event as well, and also through my speaking engagements too.
So you've obviously done a lot and ever growing by the sounds of it. How did you start all this process when obviously you're dyslexic? So a lot of organisation skills, like say you give public speaking, and I know myself, the chance of you winging it when you're public speaking is probably quite slim, I would assume. So you have to kind of at least segregate each section you're going to speak about to people. How'd you go about doing that as a dyslexic person?
Well, I believe practice makes permanent. So it's about essentially beginning to plan out your ideas initially. And I use creative ways to remember information. So I'm able to retain information really, really well, and then to speak in my framework. So it's about, in my case, I know how to maximize my recall of information, and how to share it in a way which will inspire the audience, challenge the audience, and really get them to take action whilst keeping them to account as to what they want to achieve at the same time. So I do work through a systematic approach in terms of delivery by using our systems that's proven to work and get great results from. Make it very much engaging as well, because we learn by having lots of fun. So if it's a bit boring, you won't really retain much information and so on.
So what's an example of one of those systems? What is a brief example? If you wanted to learn something, what would be a method you would use?
So in order for us to retain information, the first step is being what I call a relaxed state. Now, if we are worked up, stressed, we will not retain information. But if we are relaxed, then we will be. So it's about understanding how to get ourselves in a relaxed state so the mind is more open to learning. So that's the first step, number one. I would say that's quite important. And you can do that through quite a few ways. So, for example, playing classical music, for example, is renowned for getting the mind to be really relaxed, in a relaxed state, because we have different brain waves. And the one we need to be in is something called the alpha brain wave, which makes us a really relaxed state. And also once we are quite relaxed, then it's about using a learning system that will help you to retain, not only understand the work at hand, but be able to retain it as well.
I actually listen to classical and opera every morning.
You do?
For that reason.
Yeah, it's really good.
And if I break that, you know, you have your kind of, what they call them anchors throughout your day. That's one of my anchors. If I don't do that, my day normally doesn't go very well. So if I start going in with, I had a client phone me, I get up quite early, and I had a client phone me at 6 o'clock the other morning, which broke my normal routine. And it was so funny. It had a really weird effect on the rest of my day.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there thinking, I know this is a mental thing. I know that him phoning me at this time was nothing to do with my day, like it wouldn't have an effect on it, but my brain is convincing me everything's going wrong as a result of that. And I said, I try and to, so now I leave my phone on airplane mode until I'm ready.
that's a good call, because ultimately when we are relaxed, that's when we can make some good decisions and get lots of work done. So when I'm working, I will play classical music whilst I'm working, It helps to keep the mind in a very, very, very much a relaxed state to get work done to a high level.
It works well for me. I always listen to music when I'm working because of my ADHD. It actually entertains my brain on one side, and I can do two tasks. And whereas people go, that's crazy. But what it does is it stops my brain jump into something else.
Yeah.
So actually that really works. So one thing that interests me, how can we all become empowering teachers?
So in my first book called Empowering Parents, we use a concept called connect and cultivate. And so the idea is, in order to cultivate children's potentials, their characters, we've got to first connect with them. And so we work in three models. One is called the empowering parent, disempowering parent, and one are called the free for all parent. What differentiates the different parenting styles is the way in which we use cultivate and connection. So for clarity, connection is concerned with how we connect with children in a meaningful way, through developing the trust, through being patient, through being kind. And that's how we connect with children, by spending time with them, through praising them for their efforts, buying them gifts, and being present. Because there's a misconception of being in a household, being present, but being in the moment with children, asking them, how's your day been at school? Have you got any concerns? Taking interest in their hobbies, in their interests, and so on. Being very much in there, here and now with your children to connect with them. Spending time connecting with children helps cultivating their characters a lot easier if there's a sense of a emotional bond with our children. And the same is also for practitioners who may work with children in a capacity as a teacher, learning coach, or even just general life skills. Spending that time connecting with people puts us in a position to cultivate their characters, to see their potential and say, actually, have you considered this? Have you thought about that? Because ultimately, if we don't feel connected to somebody, are we going to be open to their comments?
Yeah.
And the answer is no. But if we connect with somebody, we're going to be more open to their suggestions.
Yeah.
And so to become an empowering parent, an empowering teacher, an empowering friend, an empowering associate, it's more geared towards how can I help you to reach your full potential? How can I support you in not only seeing your potential, but having that potential unlocked? Helping that person to discover their potential as being infinite, that you can achieve anything if you dare to believe and put the work in. And so ultimately, it's about having the connection and the cultivation in line. That's the empowering parent. Whereas the disempowering parent, for example, will major more on the cultivation and less on a connection. So what it looks like is there tends to be more sort of authoritative. You do it this way now.
Yeah.
We're not open to a discussion. We're not looking to spend more time with our children. If you're a parent or if you're a teacher, you very much, these are the rules, stick by it, and that's it. There's no rapport there, as it were.
Yeah.
Whereas an empowering teacher now, they will invest time in a children by asking them how's their day been, forming that rapport with the students, and seeing a class as individuals as opposed to one class, and us getting to know them as an individual. Because in a learning environment, if a child feels safe, if they feel they can trust the teacher, if they feel the teacher understands them as an individual, they're more inclined to be well behaved.
Yeah,
and so behavior. And for me, is a looking glass or a mirror in terms of how somebody is feeling. And so behavior is a child that is communicating that there is a unmet need of some sort.
Yeah.
And so if you are a parent, a teacher, an associate, see behavior as a way of them communicating to you that there's an unmet need. And our job is to have a discussion and reflect to see what the unmet need actually is and find a way to meet it through connecting with that young person in that sense.
I think you touched on a great point there, which is for me as a new father, and for my as is my first child, I've definitely noticed a difference between being there and being present. There's a very different set of skills, and I think that I've been present and engaged is a very big difference. Whereas if you're sitting there on your phone, it's quite funny. My daughter knows if I'm on my phone. She's only 4 months old, but the second I'm on my phone, she can tell. So I've made it a rule. There's no phones around her at the moment. But it's interesting you're saying about engaging. It is obviously that trust building thing again. I suppose it comes back to our primitive way of thinking, isn't it? When we have trust, we can grow. Without that trust, we can't really grow. And I think that goes back to when we was all in tribes and everything like that. Kind of like Simon Sinek wrote a lot about this in Leaders Eat Last, because he talks about how we still have our tribal minds. And in order to succeed in today's, we still need to follow that mindset we have, which is trust in the people around us. And I think that's what we can do with kids.
That is very important. I do agree, because once children feel that sense of trust with their parents, they're able to form meaningful relationships with friends at school, associates, if they feel that relationship is strong with their parents.
Mm.
Helps to be emotionally grounded.
Yeah.
And one thing I've come to realise over the years working with children in different environments is children who have a deep sense of connection with their parents are able to form meaningful relationships with their peers, but equally tend to be the more of the high achievers who are fulfilled.
Mm.
That's quite critical, who are fulfilled. Because our children who are successful at school, academically, but aren't necessarily fulfilled. But to have fulfilled children are the ones who parents invest their time in their children, and we get to know them as individuals, understand their strengths, support them with developing as an individual, seeing their potential. They're the ones who tend to flourish academically and in life, because they've got a strong emotional connection with their parents, which in turn helps them to be very much stable, emotionally intelligent children, who are very much aware of their peers, their own emotions and so on, which is really key as well.
So if you could, obviously your message is about you can achieve anything. So what would you say to people, predominantly children, let's say, because I think as much as adults need to hear that, I think sometimes more than anyone, we always need to start at the source, which is younger adults and children. What would be something you would say to kids who have dyslexia or neurodiversity about the future?
Well, I would say to encourage any young person, child or adult who's dyslexic, is it is your gift and not your disability. I think for too long, people see the dyslexia as a disability because there's challenges around reading and other aspects too.
Yeah.
But I made a paradigm shift years ago. It's actually my gift. It supports me to do amazing things. I've achieved things in my life that I didn't think was possible because I decided to believe that I can and see my own potential.
Yeah.
So I would just encourage any young person who's dyslexic to understand that it is your gift and not your disability.
And how would you define your gift in a really niche way?
In a really niche way, dyslexics are known to be entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Because they have the ability to be more of a people's person and more creative and the ability to sort of discern the right timing for things.
Mm-hmm.
These are all attributes of being dyslexic. And so what I would say to encourage anybody is to tune in more into your strengths and things that are more of a challenge for you.
Mm-hmm.
Get support with outsourcing it or seek to improve in that particular area.
Yeah.
But ultimately, how we see ourselves determining the results that we get. So we've got to see ourselves as being successful irrespective of our disposition.
With doing this show, every single person I meet is so different from the last. I get one or two. I've had two guests where it's like they're carbon copies of me, which was a little bit surreal. But then you get other people going, and every time, this is what I love about this subject, it's forever growing and changing. And it's like no answer fits all. But I think the key message behind anything is what we've actually got is a gift, and what we can do with it is endless. And I think it all comes down with believing in ourselves. But I do also think that extends out to everyone, really, that if you put your mind to it and your passion to it and your time, then three ingredients, I think there's generally anything, you can achieve anything.
Totally agree. And that's a key thing to understand, that what we believe we become, and believing that, you know, that you're gifted, irrespective, and that you got a bright future, irrespective, and that ultimately your potential is unlimited. And us there just to dream, think big around what you can achieve, because ultimately, once you believe that you can achieve something, you will succeed.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I think the key thing to do is just remember that you have to, in order to attain your goals in life, you need to, every day, a lot of people believe that life, achievements in life is made up of huge decisions, and they're not, they're micro decisions you make every day. And I do it by going, how does this decision I'm making in this moment, is it towards the goals I've set for the future? And if it isn't, the answer is no. Because all too often, especially when we're starting out in our careers and our businesses, we say yes to everything. And actually, there's a lot of power in no, hence why there's a book written, Power of No. And that you need to make sure that if it doesn't go towards them goals, it's not the right decision to make. And unless you have them goals clearly written out, you can't make that decision.
That is such a key point there, because in my second book, Inspire Your Child's Greatness, we work towards a methodology called Inspire Your Greatness.
Yeah.
It's based on seven pillars that will help children, young people to really excel. And the first one deals with having a clear picture of where we want to go. And that's called personal leadership. We cannot have clear direction unless we know where we're going. But the second one, the third one's actually called program. Because what's very common is we know where we want to go. We got the vision, we got the goal in mind. We're very much clear. We've thought big. We got these ideas about, you know, our future aspirations. We haven't necessarily thought about what we're doing day to day to get there. So, for example, we may have a goal to form meaningful relationships with friends and family and so on. But if on a day-to-day basis, we're always working or doing other stuff that isn't social, then how can we form meaningful relationships? That's where we've got to get into forming the right habits, the right routines, so we can reach the long-term goal. And that's quite critical, really, to attaining success alongside partnerships with mentors, professionals that can help to accelerate your progress further. Being a lifelong learner, to knowing how to learn effectively through reading or to seminars and so on, to get ourselves ahead, using education as a way to sharpen our gifts and talents. That's what I would say. It's got to have a very much a clear focus, knowing where we want to go, because as you rightfully said earlier, is once we know where we're going, then we can say yes or no based on our long-term goal. We're saying yes to this thing, help us to get to our goal, yes or no. If it's no, then decline. If it's yes, then you say yes.
Brilliant. And I completely agree with that. So if the listeners want to find you anywhere, where can they find you?
Yes, the listeners can find me at www.davyseahall.co.uk. That's my website. Or the company one, www.potentialunlocked.com. Or I'm on Facebook as well as David C. Hall, and LinkedIn as well.
Great stuff. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.